The next case is 06-1914, Douglas Groach versus General Motors Corporation. Mr. Bowman.
If it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I would like to focus my remarks this morning on three topics which are of singular importance in the present case. The first of these is the right to remedy provision of Article 1, Section 16 of the Constitution. The second is the prohibition on retroactive laws in Article 2, Section 28. And finally, I'd like to address briefly the continuing problem which we submit exists with the Article 1, Section 19 Takings Clause as it relates to the most recent version of the BWC subrogation statute. Turning attention to the first issue, Revised Code Section 230510 purports to prevent the accrual of any cause of action for product liability more than 10 years after a product has left the hands of the manufacturer. Indeed, this statute forecloses any opportunity to seek remedy even before an injury alleged to have resulted from a defective product has occurred. Because of this, it violates the right to remedy provision of Article 1, Section 16. This court in Brenneman dealt with a similar situation and held that at a minimum, Article 1, Section 16 requires an opportunity after the injury has been sustained to have access to the court to seek compensation for that injury. Indeed, in arguing for the constitutionality of the current statute of repose on product liability claims, respondents have cited to no authority from this court, which, as we stand here today, enjoys the status of current good law. The most recent pronouncement on point is that contained in Brenneman. Implicitly or explicitly, the respondent's position would require this court to overrule Brenneman and essentially reinstate the analysis offered in Cedar versus Knowlton Construction, which Brenneman overruled. I would like to suggest that overruling Brenneman would not be appropriate. It would require, and the burden would be on the respondents, to show that Brenneman should be overruled pursuant to the three-prong test, which this court announced in Westfield Insurance. I don't believe that that test could be satisfied. I would like to first point out that Brenneman is not wrongly decided. The premise in the respondent's position for the constitutionality under Article 1, 16 of the Statute of Repose is that the right to remedy protected by that provision applies only to vested accrued rights to sue, that until an injury has occurred, no right to sue exists, and if the statute extinguishes it before the accident occurs, there is no constitutional harm.
But your argument is that this is a statutorily created right to sue. Am I correct?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the cause of action is protected specifically under Article 1, Section 16. And what I'm getting at is that the analysis which is central to the respondent's position and to the Cedar analysis is that Article 1, Section 16 only protects the right to sue once the cause of action has already accrued. Allow me to suggest that if that were true, Article 1, Section 16's right to remedy clause would be nothing more than cumulative and repetitious of the prohibition on retroactive laws under Article 2, Section 28. This court specifically held in Gregory versus Flowers that legislation which retroactively extinguishes an accrued right of action is a violation of Article 2, Section 28. Now, if that's all that Article 1, Section 16 is construed to mean, it does not carry any positive meaning or have any affirmative effect in our Constitution other than to be a repetitive and less complete articulation of principles already covered under Article 2, Section 28.
Now, let me try to bring you back to the question. There was a dissent written in Brenneman, and I think it argues that since the statutorily created right has been abrogated, it doesn't exist, and therefore there's no denial.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm not getting it.
All right. You're talking about a statutorily created right to file an action. Am I correct?
Product liability is a statutory cause of action.
And does the legislature have the right to eliminate that?
I believe that the authority of the legislature to eliminate or modify a cause of action is subject to constitutional constraint. And I believe that that constraint comes from Article 1, Section 16 of the Constitution. The only example of which I'm aware in which a cause of action has been totally eliminated, and this court has upheld that constitutionally, is the abolition of the common law torts of alienation of affection and criminal conversation. And that was discussed specifically in Hardy versus Vermeulen over 20 years ago. In that decision, there is a footnote which specifically explains that the abolition of those torts was not a violation of Article 1, Section 16, because 116 protects the right to remedy for injury in person, property, or reputation, and the so-called amatory causes of action did not touch upon any of those protected interests. If that answers
Thank
your question,
you.
Your Honor. For this reason, I believe that Brenneman and cases which predated it, establishing that Article 1, Section 16 prevents legislative action which forecloses any possibility of remedy after the injury has occurred, was properly decided. I would briefly comment as well that Brenneman does not defy practical workability. In Westfield, this court dealt with the Scott Ponser case. The decision in Westfield talked about a morass of litigation, more than 90 cases pending before this court alone at the time of that decision to try to unravel the confusion wrought by the Scott Ponser decision. In Brenneman, you cannot similarly find practical unworkability because it offers a bright line rule. There's nothing confusing, there's nothing ambiguous about it, and it's not difficult to apply. I'd next like to touch briefly on Article 2, Section 28. I've previously alluded to Gregory versus Flowers, which I think is significant in this connection, because it squarely holds that a retroactive enactment which takes away an accrued substantive right of action is prohibited by Article 2, Section 28. Now, in this case, the statute 230510F, which became effective on April 7th of 2005, provides that the statute of repose will apply to any action commenced on or after the effective date, regardless of when the cause of action accrues. The effect of this statute is to provide that, regardless of when the cause of action accrued, if you didn't get to the courthouse and get your complaint filed before April 7, 2005, that cause of action is wiped out. Now, to apply the Article 2, Section 28 analysis to this case, the petitioner sustained an injury on March 3rd of 2005. His cause of action in product liability accrued at the time that injury was sustained, and that cause of action was limited by the law in effect at that time only by his obligation to comply with the 2-year statute of limitations and to commence his action no later than March 3, 2007. Barely more than a month after he sustained his injury, the statute of repose takes effect and is purported to apply retroactively to eliminate his right to sue. This, if applied to this case, it would totally bar going forward with the product liability cause of action. Now, that right to sue existed on March 3rd of 2005. It vested at that time, and to apply the statute of repose retroactively to it would clearly take away the right to sue, which in Gregory versus Flowers, and more recently in Van Fossen, this court said could not be done, consistent with Article 2, Section 28. So as applied to the claims of this petitioner, I would submit that this court must, at a minimum, hold that the retroactive application of the statute of repose in this case is prohibited by Article 2, Section 28. I would like to touch briefly, Your Honors, on the BWC subrogation issue. A good bit has been written, and I approach this issue with some trepidation because I've never discussed a mathematical formula in a courtroom without making it clear to everyone present why I'm not an engineer or an accountant.
Well, the allegation or the representation to us is that the interested entities, the plaintiff's bar.
Sorry, Mr. Chief Justice, I'm having difficulty.
The representation is to us in one of the briefs that the interested parties or entities got together and agreed on a response to our decision at Holton, and that we now have the new subrogation law, upon which varying interests seem to have agreed. Is that an accurate reading of the status of the?
It is my understanding, Your Honor, that there were negotiations between certain interest groups and organizations which culminated in this statute. I certainly was not a participant in any of that, and I'm not privy to what went on there, nor, for that matter, were the petitioners in this case whose rights are affected by it. I believe, Your Honor, that even if the parties agree, if what has been agreed to violates the Constitution, I think it is the Constitution which has to control.
Sure, now, but it seems to me that the state argues, and of course General Motors argue, that they go through a step-by-step analysis of what the court held in Holton were deficiencies in the previous subrogation law, and that the General Assembly rather carefully responded to those deficiencies, and that we have a new subrogation law which now is constitutional because it has alleviated or responded to those deficiencies. You disagree because the math doesn't work, right?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that the new subrogation law represented an effort to cure the deficiencies identified in Holton and Modzelewski. I would disagree that it succeeded. And the best evidence I can offer you in that connection is the Legislative Service Commission analysis of the new law, which is discussed at length both in the state of Ohio's brief and in the petitioner's reply brief. Very briefly, that analysis posits an example of a net tort recovery in the amount of $70,000 with a subrogation interest of $60,000 and uncompensated damages which by definition do not reflect a double recovery, in the amount of $50,000. Now, according to the LSC analysis, when the formula provided by statute is applied, the subrogee receives $38,182 and the claimant receives $31,182, or a little more than 60% of the actual amount of uncompensated damages, which do not implicate any element of double recovery. So he's lost between 35 and 40% of the amount which Holton says the state has no claim against. There is still a taking of money, which is not a double recovery. I have well exceeded the time I intended to use, and I'm well into my rebuttal time, and I will reserve the balance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bowman. Mr. Eddy.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I represent the respondent, Card Corporation and Racine Federated in this case. I will be addressing the open courts and retroactivity propositions of law today. Elise Porter, on behalf of the Ohio Attorney General's Office, will be addressing the workers' compensation subrogation issues. At the outset, before addressing the open courts provision and the retroactivity provision, I want to emphasize that we must be cognizant of the strong presumption of constitutionality that Senate Bill 80 enjoys and carries into this court. That presumption has several components that I want to lay out because I think they are critical to this court's understanding of how it's going to approach the open courts provision, given the case law precedent here, as well as the retroactivity portion. The burden of proof is on the petitioner here in challenging these provisions to show beyond a reasonable doubt that the challenged statutory provisions are utterly incompatible with a constitutional provision. The challenged provision must be given every benefit of benefit of presumption of constitutionality. The rules of construction of both the statutory provision and the constitutional provision should be applied in favor of finding of constitutionality. And this is a stringent level of analysis.
Help me understand the statute of repose application. The statute of repose says that if you have anything that occurs in the first 10 years, you can bring suit, correct? And then if it's after 10 years, the statute of repose prevents a cause of action accruing, according to your definition. Is that correct?
That is correct. There are some exceptions to the application of the 10-year period that are set forth.
If the cause of action occurs in the first 10 years, let's say it occurs in year four, how long do they have to bring it? 6 years? Or is there a 1 or 2 year statute limitation?
They have the 2 year period under the statute. The 10 year under the normal statute of limitations for a product liability claim.
Okay.
The statute of repose acts as sort of a backstop to the bringing of a cause of action after 10 years from
the date. Okay, so if the injury occurs 9 years and 10 months, you're still within your 10 years.
Yes, you are.
You have the 2 years product liability.
You get the additional. That's one of the exceptions that perhaps it's not truly an exception, but it's built into the statute that if you're in that last 2 year period, you get the additional period of time that might take you beyond the 10 years.
Then how is the plaintiff in this case cut off? His injury occurred in March or whatever, the statute like went into effect in a year later. How is he cut off? Did his occur after the 10 years, and that's why he's claiming it's cut
yes,
off?
Yes, this product was supplied to General Motors in November of 1977. Mm-hmm. So under the statute, 10 years from that date would have been 1987.
So that's his retroactivity argument, not that he doesn't have time to bring it, but that his cause of action that expired long ago under the statute of repose.
It's not so much that I think Your Honor is sort of treading upon the retroactivity provision of it and not necessarily the Brenneman aspect of the argument here. But with respect to the retroactivity portion of it, our position has been that the cause of action, which we contend is extinguished by operation of the statute, is not a vested right.
Right. And I understand your argument. I'm just trying to In the statute, the way it's structured, if it occurs within the 10 years, but you're like a month away from the 10 years, you still have time to bring it.
Yes, you do.
Okay.
And there was a window of 30 days before the effective date of the statute after the injury. But it was, the action was filed in June of 2006.
But his argument on retroactivity, I thought, was that he had a good cause of action 1 month before the statute became effective, and the statute of repose became effective. Before that, there wasn't any. And he had a good cause of action, and the statute was adopted and said, you don't have a good cause of action. That sounds like retroactivity, doesn't it?
Well, it's our position, Mr. Chief Justice, that that is merely an expectancy interest. This is a statutory right, and the legislature can change that statutory right at will.
Well, expectancy, he had the law said you have a right.
Well,
and that's more than just an expectancy, isn't it?
Well, the
are you saying because he didn't file it, it was an expectancy, but had he filed it the day he was injured, it wouldn't have been an expectancy?
No, our position is that the right that he's speaking of is not vested in a constitutional sense. And the rule is that a right is not vested in that sense unless it amounts to something more than a mere expectation or interest based upon an anticipated continuance of existing law. And I would cite the court to the Tipton versus Hatch case that was decided. I would also make reference to this most recent decision of City of East Liverpool versus Columbiana County. And while that didn't deal with a tort action, it was a city's challenge under House Bill 329 that changed how money was going to be distributed amongst municipalities under an alternative apportionment scheme. The court here rejected the argument that permitted a retrospective extinguishment of the city's pre-existing legal right under the former statute. And the language that the majority used in denying that retroactivity argument was no one has a vested right in having the law remain the same over time. And we said we distinguish vested rights from mere privilege conferred by statute, which could be exercised so long as the statute remained in effect. And that's what our position here is, that the statute changed, just as the statute changed in City of East Liverpool.
But the statute didn't change before the injury occurred. And I think that we're having a little trouble with the fact that, I mean, sure, you can wipe out or change the law, or the legislature can, once, but not affect individuals who an event occurred to that took something away from them, in other words, injured them, and then kind of pull the rug out from under them with regards to how they could recover.
I understand the difficulty. I guess the position is that when you say pull the rug out from underneath them, they must have something, a right, that is vested in the constitutional sense. And we don't believe that just having a cause of action, having been injured by a product, is a vested right in that sense, at least not until you initiate the machinery of the court judicial process by filing a lawsuit. I think that's a different situation that we have factually here. And in fact, the statute is written so that it is intended to have prospective application to cause of action filed in court after its effective date.
Mr. Eddy, the individual who's injured, although the statute of repose is protecting the manufacturer basically after 10 years of the product delivery, we're saying after 10 years of the product being delivered, the new statute is saying you don't sue the manufacturer, but you still have the right to go against the individual.
Correct.
In control of the machinery or in possession of the machinery.
Correct. And under there was a remaining remedy against General Motors, which is a party to this case, and that would be a consideration directed to the open courts provision itself.
Right. Could you address the Galatis issue with Brenneman? Because Mr. Bowman was saying that the test cannot be met, and I understand that at least the amicus brief here has seemed to address it on the other hand.
Yes, it's our position that, first, Brenneman, as a technical matter, need not be formally overruled. It did deal with a different statute, the statute of repose with respect to improvements to real property. So technically, the syllabus holding there would not apply to the product liability statute. However, it is our belief that in order to uphold this statute of repose, we think that more likely than not, the court's going to need to follow the rationale, at least, set forth in the Cedar versus Knowlton case, and we would ask that the court do that. I can see I've gone over my
Counsel,
time.
Counsel, before you sit down, could I have a follow-up question on explaining the statute of repose. If one is riding in an elevator that is in a building, a high-rise building that is more than 10 years old, and a component of the elevator, assuming the elevator is installed in is 10 years old as well, not just the building. A component breaks and the elevator drops and one is seriously injured. Or if one is flying in an airplane that is more than 10 years old and a component malfunctions, causes the airplane to crash. Or if one is in a cherry picker that is more than 10 years old and a component breaks and one is injured. Recovery is cut off, is that correct?
Are you speaking of a suit against the elevator manufacturer or a suit
Yes.
against the component of the elevator?
Well, whoever manufactured the product that caused the problem.
I think my understanding of the statute, there's language in the statute that is sort of an exception to it with respect to components, but it's my belief in answer to your question that the cause of action against the manufacturer of the elevator would be cut off by the 10-year statute of repose.
So what is left?
Well,
what remedy is left? You told Justice Lansinger there's a remedy left. What is it?
An action against the building owner that owned and maintained the elevator, the repair. Whatever maintenance
so
and repair.
So a negligence action against the building owner or the owner of the airplane for the malfunction of a component that they couldn't discover would be what you had left.
Well, under the open, there is still a remedy available to the injured person. It's not a remedy, however, available against the manufacturer of the product.
But I'm asking as a... I assume you're a litigator. As a practical matter, what is practically left? What remedy, meaningful remedy, is left if you can't go against the manufacturer of the product that caused the problem?
This gets back to the initial concept of the statute of repose. The statute of repose posits that it doesn't regulate the time within which a person can bring a lawsuit. It regulates the time period within which the product is going to be considered defective at all. So under that instance, with a statute of repose, the theory is that it's no longer a wrong, that it has a right to go into
court
attached to it.
So when you crawl on an airplane that's more than 10 years old, or get in an elevator that's more than 10 years old, or go up in a cherry picker that's more than 10 years old, user beware.
Well, with respect to the product, with respect to a claim against the manufacturer, yes, but there are other potential defendants in each of those instances, I believe.
My question is presupposing that the cause of the accident, the cause of the injury, is the product itself, not some failure to maintain
Yes.
or any of those things. So any product that's more than 10 years old, if the product malfunctions, breaks, what have you, and causes injury, tough luck.
There are exceptions to exceptions for asbestos and chromium and
but
some
generally,
other things built
tough
in. Generally,
luck.
That is correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eddy. Ms. Porter, Mr. Eddy, we've given Mr. Eddy more than his 7.5 minutes, so you take, you have 31 seconds, but take 5 minutes, see what you can do with 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I want to speak to this morning about the workers' comp subrogation aspect of the case. And I want to point out that the present statute was an attempt to solve the three problems that this court identified with former revised code 4123-931. And we believe, obviously, that the General Assembly succeeded in addressing and solving those problems. First of all, the former statute made an entire judgment subject to subrogation, and that brought up a takings problem because the claimant often was left with nothing after going through trial against a tortfeasor. And the way that it solves that problem is it sets up this formula that was referred to earlier. And it ensures no takings in a couple of different ways. First of all, the proven damages subtracts out the subrogee's interest. So the part of the formula that we're talking about in which you start with the claimant's interest already subtracts out the subrogee's interest. What you usually have in these cases, and what really brings up the problem here, is you have a pot of money from a judgment or a settlement that usually is not enough to cover the interest of both the claimant and the subrogee. And so the General Assembly came up with a formula that separates that judgment out in a pro rata fashion. So the claimant gets a pro rata share, and the subrogee gets roughly an equal percentage of their interest in that formula. But I must also point out a couple of things that make this significantly different from the other, the previous law. First of all, the claimant gets his entire attorney fees and costs paid off the top. Secondly, the claimant gets the complete amount of any punitive damages. Then what's left is split between the claimant and the subrogee. The second problem that Holton brought up was that under the former law, it required the claimant to disgorge the entire amount of future estimated benefits, and he was never able to get any portion of that back, even if it turns out that the future estimate was inaccurate. Exactly the opposite is now true. After you've gone through the formula and you've split the amount between the claimant and the subrogee, the subrogee's amount, the portion of the subrogee's amount that represents future benefits, can be put into an interest-bearing trust account. And if for some reason that stream of income is cut off, the remainder of the trust account actually goes to the claimant rather than the subrogee. So that problem is also solved. And then finally, the former law treated those who went to trial and those who settled differently. The current law, although there are some differences, applies the same formula to a judgment or to a settlement amount. So it's treating the two situations much more similarly than the former law.
Mr. Bowman says that even under this new law, his client loses some fund, some money that he should have gotten.
Well, that is certainly true. The claimant doesn't necessarily get his entire amount of his uncompensated damages. But what I think is a misconception sometimes in this case, the subrogee is also an injured party. And the claimant and the subrogee both have claims against the third-party tortfeasor. The subrogee is out the amount of workers' compensation outlay that he's put out to compensate the claimant. And so this is really an attempt to split that judgment between two plaintiffs, if you will, two injured parties that have an entitlement to those funds.
How does the new act handle attorney fees? Because in some of these subrogation claims, the subrogee used to, or was always trying to figure out a way how to get a free ride, make the injured party pay the entire attorney fee, when in reality part of the recovery is for the benefit of the subrogee. Do they address that?
The way it works is that it's my understanding the way it works is that the claimant gets his attorney fees paid before you even start going through the formula. So the subrogee has to pay for his attorney fees out of whatever he gets from the judgment. It's my understanding in the statute. Whereas the claimant, before you even...
So the pot is diminished by the attorney fee.
Correct.
Before you start splitting it.
Correct.
So theoretically, then, the subrogee is contributing toward the attorney fee.
Theoretically, that's correct, yes. The subrogee is not only contributing towards the attorney fees, but the subrogee is also...
If they have a separate attorney...
Then they have to pay for
pay
it
that
on their
as
own.
Well. But if they don't, they're making a contribution
In an indirect way. They're making a contribution towards the attorney fees. Okay. That's correct. And, of course, again, people can always settle, and the safety valve under settlement is you can settle, you know, in whatever way you feel
sure.
is fair. And it's possible under a settlement situation that the attorney fees would be handled differently. But under the formula, that's the way they're handled. Yes, Your Honor.
Under the formula, does the subrogee, which would be the Bureau of Workers' Compensation or a self-insured employer, do they ever get more than they actually paid out in compensation?
The subrogee?
The subrogee?
No. And the only time the subrogee would ever get everything is if the judgment was, in fact, enough to cover the uncompensated damages and the subrogation interest, in which case you wouldn't even have to go through the formula. Everybody would get their share, and that would be
never
it.
Get more than they actually paid
never.
Out
in fact, they almost always get considerably less than their interest in the judgment. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Porter. Mr. Bowman, you have 17 seconds, but I would guess you might want to take more than that since we've given appellees considerably more time. You're not required to, by the way.
A statutory subrogee under Ohio law does not have its own independent cause of action against a third-party tortfeasor, the only exception to that being this court's decision in Leedex versus Heatbath about 20 years ago, which allows a cause of action based on contract. I've already addressed Article 1, Section 16. I do no more at this point than reiterate my core contention, which is that Article 1, Section 16 of the Constitution requires, as this court said in Brenneman, at a minimum, the opportunity to seek compensation for an injury after the injury has occurred. This statute does not provide that opportunity. This statute is unconstitutional. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.